from WBUR Boston and PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Buried in the browser wars, there's a bigger conflict brewing about who's going to control the World Wide Web. The war for the web is fought in battles over cryptography, laws, and code. It's a fight over who controls the architecture of the web, who defines the domains and interactions that happen in cyberspace. Popular media hypes the big man theory, software titan Bill Gates maneuvering for hegemony. The capitalist analysis says that commerce will win out in the end. And then there's the populist take that the power must go to the people. Trouble is, there's no template for any of this. Big money and power politics have history on their side. But is it possible that the wild, wild web really is a medium beyond control, the dream vehicle for free speech and democracy, mapping out the cyberfront? The war for the web is next on The Connection. First, this news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. It's the preoccupation and the real day-to-day occupation of a lot of people these days to understand the Internet and to anticipate where it's going. Our guest this hour, Jonathan Zittrain, is one of those people. He says when most of us look at the Internet, we're not seeing the forest for the trees. By concentrating on issues like free speech and defamation or privacy or security or commerce and encryption, we're missing the big picture. Jonathan Zittrain says it's the technology and the people who design and control and make money off it that we should be looking at. The architecture of the Internet defines what we can and cannot do online. Too often, we're assuming that the way the net is, the way it is now, is the way it'll always be. We're talking about where the Internet is headed this hour and who stands to gain the most from it. Connection this news. Is the Internet going to eat your job? Or is it going to make you rich? Tell us about your Internet worries, your Internet dreams. What do you want most to protect in cyberspace? Is it privacy? Is it free speech? Is it anonymity? Or is it commerce? Do you think big money or Big Brother have designs on the design of the web? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Zittrain teaches cyber law at the Harvard Law School, and he's the executive director of Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jonathan Zittrain, it's on my mind all the time that everybody I know is talking Internet night and day. Everybody wants to be at the right place whenever it is, 2001, when this gusher of money and power kicks in. It's sort of like, you know, everybody's got a chance again to invest in television in 1945 or in Coca-Cola in 1918 or whatever. Where should we be? How should we look at this monster?
I suppose, you know, it really has hit the common parlance when even Homer Simpson in one episode has actually set up his own internet business with the little bird that dips into the water and tips back and forth. And he's not exactly sure what he's doing, but he's ready to make the money when the money is there to be had.
The cash flow hasn't started yet, but it's going to be, I suppose.
Yes, indeed. The network that we know as the Internet started as a highly non-commercial venture. In fact, people were fond of saying that the National Science Foundation, which had provided a lot of the money to get the thing started, completely eschewed anything commercial, that you weren't allowed to do anything commercial on the net. That wasn't something that was readily enforced, but it was such a widely understood norm that people didn't even try to explore the money-making potentials of the net until quite later on, say the early 90s. It actually started, some people mark it as a group of lawyers, actually, went on to what's known as Usenet. Usenet is a means of having public discussions over the Internet. You can post messages, anybody at large can see them and respond, and you get into discussions. And these lawyers decided to advertise their law firm through it. I mean, it seems like such an obvious idea now that we live in an era of junk email and rampant advertising across the net. The first reaction to them was not pleasant. People actually sought to take out their site. Various people, vigilantes you might say, said this isn't appropriate behavior and shut them down. They were not daunted. They came back, and little did we know then, it was the wave of the future.
Now everybody's got a site, and of course, it's not the whole story, but Internet stocks and speculation about what's going to work in that world is sort of everybody's preoccupation on Wall Street, too. But even beyond Internet stocks. We have to talk about the sort of the classic internet stock, Amazon.com, say, that has a huge trading activity, even though it doesn't make money yet. But take it even bigger than that. What should we be thinking about sort of on the eve of this explosion?
I suppose with respect to commerce, the thing to think about is, first, the realization that nobody has the formula yet. You have a lot of people trying different things. Some of them are entrepreneurs. They start with a simple idea. They have kind of the Amazon model. They'll build their own brand. They'll get out there and try their own things. And the way the market is, as you've just pointed out, on Wall Street or in the venture capitals of the United States and elsewhere, if you have a good idea, the idea is you go out to Silicon Valley, shake a tree, and a venture capitalist will fall out and promptly hand you $1 million. It may not be exactly as simple as that, but there certainly is plenty of money floating around wanting to invest in any idea that looks colorable in the hopes that it will pay off big. Of course, you also have the big players getting in. Barnes & Noble is the wonderful counterpart to Amazon.com. You kind of have the clash of the David and the Goliath as each tries to build on their traditional base. One, the kind of fleet-footed entrepreneur. The other, Barnes & Noble, building on a brand they have and worrying all the while that for every book they sell in cyberspace, it's one fewer book they're going to sell in the real world in a Barnes & Noble store.
So how are they dealing with it? I mean, that's a sort of a classic instance. They have real estate all over the country. They have stacks of books, you know, attractively laid out for people who want to walk in and buy it. They can also see the logic is that people are going to dial these up on a machine and get them overnight express any day now. And so it becomes important to figure out what will be left in the way of stores, how long your lease should be on it, this kind of thing, but also when is the moment that it's all going to kick in. The same thing applies, say, to newspapers and classified ads. It'll be much simpler to look for a house on the internet than in the classified pages, or for a job, or to sell your boat, or buy a used car. When is this transition going to come?
Well, there are two things to look for to see when the transition's really going to happen. The first thing is to see when these things called microtransactions is going to take place. Microtransactions are the dream of a lot of internet entrepreneurs. Basically, the idea is you can go to a website, you'll see something that looks appealing, perhaps a recipe for chocolate chip cookies. And that, if it's not in a collection of recipes in a nicely bound volume, isn't something you'd pay $9.95 for, unless it's a really good recipe. But in the meantime, microtransactions says you could click on it, and just like that, you've spent a nickel, and you've got the recipe. And if it turns out it isn't that good, well, it was only a nickel. I mean, it's like not that big a deal. And as a result, the idea is you could have people spending nickels and dimes across the internet, people selling at the price of nickels and dimes across the internet. You could have Uncle Bob designate himself a storyteller, and every night, using technology like Real Audio, I understand NPR uses that too,
right,
read a story to the net at large. Anybody who wants to tune in can. Maybe it'll cost a nickel, maybe it won't. And through that means you'd have lots of little transactions instead of big transactions taking place for which people are reluctant to actually put down the money until they have a brand they
can trust. You say people are watching the traffic in microtransactions. What is, for example, what are they watching?
Well, one thing you'd look for is convergence to a single standard. And by that, it means you're looking to see how can everybody end up using the same kind of microtransaction currency, whatever it'll be. If my microtransaction nickels are issued by one quasi-bank, and somebody's website who wants to accept these nickels expects them in another, we can't have a meeting of the minds. We can't actually have our deal. And what you basically need is critical mass for one system to step forward and say, this is going to be the dominant system. And you see that pattern repeated again and again on the internet. You have kind of an early stage where there's lots of different standards competing. Because there is no one dominant standard, nothing wins and you don't have progress in the area. And then for one reason or another, it might be pure chance, something comes forward, is sort of designated the heir apparent, and then everybody flows to it.
Are the policy, the design, the management, the architecture questions really important? Or, I mean, I think most people's conception of the internet, and mine, for example, is that it's sort of like the architecture of space. It's infinite. Nobody really knew what they were doing. We can all use it forever. And that the action is among entrepreneurs who figure out how to play it. Am I wrong in thinking, I mean, are there sort of big picture actually building that highway, designing it, making sure it's open, making sure it's democratic, etc., that we ought to know about?
Absolutely. It turns out that for the longest time, given that the internet was the province of academics and computer science academics at that, there'd be loose confederations, people that got together that just happened to know what worked, and their goal would be the most efficient thing. There's actually a fellow named Dave Clark at MIT who was fond of saying, with respect to the governance of the code of the internet, we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. You actually see this on T-shirts of people in the know now. And that's a system that's now starting to become quite brittle. And the reason is that because there's so much money, and now maybe some policy issues, built into whether the internet goes one way or another, it's difficult for just the engineers to make these choices. One great example would be Dave Clark, the guy who coined that phrase, is working on ways that certain packets on the internet can go faster and others can go slower to their destinations. Now, from an engineer standpoint, this is a great idea. This is the kind of thing where if you're trying to stream audio at somebody, it's very important that the packet stream not be interrupted. If you're sending somebody some documents or email, it's okay if there's a five-second delay between the first half of the email.
This is built trains against, express trains.
Exactly. So there's a real nice engineering problem there. But in addition, you can imagine, once you have the way to designate certain packets as more equal than others, you have the means of starting to say who was a first-class citizen on the internet and who was not.
If you had to sort of tell, your mother-in-law or a Martian, big-picture questions that you worry about, for the internet, where would you begin? And then we'll go to calls.
I guess I would start by worrying that the kinds of technologies they're developing right now to enable nice commerce, microtransactions is one of them. Others include authentication, so that you know that the person you're talking to on the internet is who he or she says she is. So if Domino's Pizza gets an order for 15 pizzas, they need to know that the person placing the order really wants those pizzas and that they can vouch that that address that's given is where the pizzas can go. Now, that technology, once developed, is exactly the same kind of technology that would let a government, let's say it's Minnesota, say that they don't want their citizens gambling online. They have a policy in their state, you're not allowed to gamble. And they can now fairly ask of internet gambling sites, don't let anybody from Minnesota in. Because you can now authenticate where people are or are not from, that site could reasonably, quite easily say, fine, we'll just automatically stop Minnesotans at the door. That's a different net than people are used to right now. People are very used to just wandering around anonymously and not being able, the joke consistently has been on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. And similarly here, maybe you're 16 years old, you can still get to the pornography site. There's no way to know who's 16, who's 21. That could change.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain. He's the executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. Andy is calling from Cambridge.
Hi.
Hello, Andy.
Could I start with a personal question to Mr. Zittrain? It sounds like you've been talking to Lawrence Lessig a lot, what you said about anonymity. He's also a professor at Harvard. Are you connected?
Absolutely. Lawrence Lessig is actually the Berkman Professor at Harvard Law School, and he is a fellow of our center and a dear friend, and very much somebody whose ideas, they call them the New Chicago School, and I suppose I'm one of the many disciples of it.
Oh. It happens he's going to be a keynote at a conference in October that discusses a lot of the things that I think are coming up today. Would it be wrong for me to give a little plug, just mention the conference?
Go ahead.
Okay, it's run by Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. And there isn't anything on the website yet, but very soon there will be, www.cpsr.org. It's going to be in Boston on October 10th, and I'll let it go at that.
Okay, Andy, send us an invitation. We should get to know Lawrence Lessig, too, before we need him.
Well, I'll take you up. Can
okay.
I mention a few things that I consider important
Please.
In the web of the future? I agree that anonymity is worth preserving. That's a really great thing a lot of people take advantage of. Also, Mr. Zittrain was pointing out there'll probably be different tiers of service. If you pay a little more, you can get enough bandwidth to get a movie, maybe. And I think that's a great innovation, and it should happen. But there are some risks on that, and some of them are too technologically complex to get into, like whether small internet service providers can give this service, so whether they'll survive. But one of the major things I like to do is make sure that you preserve the low cost, low bandwidth access that we all have now, like $20 a month for best service you can get. A lot of people pointed out that the web would never have taken off if people couldn't have this flat rate pricing. You know, you do whatever you want, you stay on as long as you want, doesn't matter. If they didn't have that, they wouldn't have been willing to experiment, and they wouldn't have made the web the success that it is. The other thing I'd like to mention is that it's very important for the small voice to exist. Like the little guy who wants to talk about the Zapatistas and Chapas or something. This makes the web really valuable. And even though I would like to see the Disneys and so forth come online, I would also like the little guy to be reachable.
What's the threat to the small voices, Andy?
What about the small voices?
What is the threat to the small voices?
Well, one threat is that there will be a lot of high pricing. You'll have to pay for your for each bit that you get, as I mentioned, and that would mean that people are less willing to check out somebody who's small and weird and unknown. Another threat is that you just can't find them. Already, search engines are under strain. You can't really find a lot of good things in the search engine. Though I would like to have better search engines, yellow pages, and things that could distinguish, say, between the web, meaning World Wide Web, and the web, referring to duck feet, and the web, referring to spider's web, and so forth. If you have this kind of intelligent indexing, then I think it would be easier for people to find exactly what they're looking for, and it would help the nonprofit organizations and so forth.
Jonathan Zittrain, comment.
There's certainly a school of thought, and Andy represents it very well, that when you have unlimited bandwidth, and people think of this now as unlimited bandwidth, so anybody can pretty much put up a website, the next problem you run into is there is not unlimited attention. It's no good putting up a website if nobody ends up seeing it. And technically, people could get to it if only they were to enter its address in. They could type in www.something.com and get to the website, or maybe find it in a search engine. But then you get into these worries that, well, what if the search engines aren't on your side? What if they refuse to list your site?
Right.
And by way of convergence to standards that we were talking about before, it may be that there will only be one or two search engines out there that have everybody's attention. And once those search engines have everybody's attention, those are the ones that if you're not listed, you might as well not even be there. It's kind of like being relegated to UHF Siberia on the TV dial, and people just never quite get up that high in the numbers to find you. That's a problem. What to do about it is another question. I mean, there are some who actually say that you need some kind of almost FCC fairness doctrine-like rule where whoever controls the central space, whoever happens to be lucky enough to do it, maybe it's Microsoft with their startup screen, maybe it's one of these so-called portal sites or search engines, they have to have some judgment other than their own "we'll sell it to the highest bidder" by which to populate that space. Now, of course, that has all sorts of questions it raises as to how would you decide what...
Do the search engines have to list you if you want to be listed? I mean, if you put a Jonathan Zittrain page on the web and I dial you up looking for you, do they have to find you for me?
Well, there are two things. The general way you use a search engine is you go in and you may type in something into a box indicating what you want to find, Chiapas
right.
or something. Those engines answer only to themselves as to what they list or don't list. Now, many of them will tell you, in order to be most useful to people, they will list as much as possible.
Right.
But they don't want to return a zillion hits when you type in Chiapas, because it's just too many. So they'll start going by rules to list the most popular ones, the things they think you want to see most. Those may or may not be the kind of marginal small voice sites that you would have an interest in listing, and you are somewhat at their mercy. The other point is domain names. Domain names are those kind of catchy names, www.something.something, that let somebody get immediately to your site. And the way domain names work, once you've been assigned the name, if somebody types it in, more or less, they're going to be able to get to your site. There's just a big battle now to say who will get the most mnemonic, most easily remembered names and hang on to them.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection with Jonathan Zittrain. Alan is calling from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Hi-ho.
Hello, Alan.
Hey, living in my virtual reality with my virtual neighbors who I virtually never see since my face is plastered to another screen. Keep them asking the wrong questions. They'll forever seek the wrong answers. My two questions are, who cares and why do so many people care? Now, Christopher, remember back when things were interesting. Trickster makes the world.
Yes. That was the question.
There's a wonderful book by Bob Putnam, who's a sociologist at Harvard. And
Mr. Bowling Alone, right?
Yes, Mr. Bowling Alone. And he tries to document what he sees as trends, perhaps intertwined with the development of the Internet, but he documents it independent of that, that says that basically people are becoming more alienated. They don't have the community groups they used to have. They don't get out that much. And as a result, a lot of their primary contact with the world is in this kind of one-way mode of they sit down, they become a couch potato, and they tune into the television. Some might say one reason to worry, or at least why the Internet matters, is that it holds out the promise of actually communicating with people, not just people local to you who could collectively make it to your Elks Lodge on occasion, but people who are across the country and might share your interests and be able to exchange ideas on various subjects. And that is one promise of the Internet that helps sort of ameliorate Bob Putnam's problem, and at the same time open up new opportunities. So that's kind of the positive reason, at least, of why you might want to care about the net.
1-800-423-8255. Big picture on the technology of the electronic millennium, the Internet. 1-800-423-TALK. Douglas is calling from Chatham, Massachusetts.
I was wondering if you could discuss some major areas that I think need development before the web will really take off. And those would be like speed and access, in the access and the ease of connecting. Now, I mean, there was a lot of debate over AOL and busy signals. And then the second real areas are reliability and security, or at least the impression of it. You know, a lot of people talk about, oh, somebody can steal my credit card. And in the real world, it's probably a lot simpler to steal someone's credit card, or at least the carbon copy of it. And I think there's some new technologies that are really going to help these areas, ADSL and cable TV for connecting. And in terms of security, the PGP encryption has been really successful.
It's a variety of issues. Security, ease of connection, reliability. Jonathan?
These are good examples of standards that are fighting to emerge. And again, once they sort of dominate, they might be the things that will take the net, as you just started the hour, to the next level. With respect to reliability, it's true. We want to make sure we can get people onto the net and get them on quickly and efficiently. A lot of that is happening. You have a big battle going on right now between your telephone companies. That's the so-called ADSL technology that's emerging. The cable companies, and then people like AOL or other internet service providers, so-called ISPs. All of them want to be the ones who get you onto the net. There'll also be people who want to get you on with wireless. And I guess my sense is this is happening. There are people hard at work doing it. Lots and lots of money is getting plowed into it, including a wiring up of the schools and libraries as part of a federal initiative. And it's around the corner. Interestingly, this is sort of part of a tripartite scheme. The first was fast processors, computers that could think really quickly. The second was fast networks, and that's the stage we're at right now. And the third might be cheap and fast sensors, things that can detect things. The question will be what happens when you get your toaster onto the Internet.
I want to know, I mean, especially in the communication biz, but also in retailing, also in education, everybody assumes that we're going to be living on that Internet in 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You'll go to school on the Internet, or you'll do your research on your Internet. You'll look for jobs, or you'll buy a house or sell your house on the Internet. When people ask you, Jonathan, I want to have my money on the right number in 2002 or whatever, what do you tell them? Who's thinking about it creatively? Who's thinking about it realistically? I'm assuming that the world's going to be a different place in 3-4 years, and that we all want to we all want to survive this transition. How do we do it?
Well, one big question will be whether we end up in sort of an open or a closed environment on the Internet. And I can explain what that means. And that sort of will determine where to place the bets and, in fact, what kind of Internet it's going to be. A closed environment is one where most of the software on which it runs is proprietary. There's some company that owns it and licenses it to everybody mm-hmm. else on terms that they decide. And where most of the public spaces you see are, again, ones that are in private hands, for better or for worse. And if that's the case, you'd be wanting to place your bets with whomever you think the giants are going to manage to be. The CNNs of the world, the ABCs, maybe even the Barnes & Nobles, whoever is likely to sort of be the singular player in that space. The other vision is one of openness, one of sort of shared code where maybe not everybody, but at least people who are versed as programmers can actually add their own chunks to the collective internet or write their own software that they then share with other people. And in that case, the successful internet is one that's very much more distributed. And the bets you'd place would be with the smaller companies that may not have to strike it really big to strike it big, but can just do a great job in their one niche.
1-800-423-8255 makes the internet connection. Al is calling from Boston.
Hello, Professor Citrine. I was calling because I had a question about and you actually mentioned that the internet gambling and you know, the Senate, I believe, last week passed a law stating that internet gambling was essentially banned. And I'm wondering how it is they're going to manage to enforce that in an age where certainly I, as a, you know, internet professional, can simply move to the Turks and Caicos Islands and set up an internet site and have internet gambling, and what's to stop Americans from gambling on my site unless we really are entering the age of Big Brother where the government's going to see everything you do?
Well, without having to call it the age of Big Brother, I think we really could be entering an era where it's a lot easier for the government to regulate the space. And this is something, again, that Larry Lessig has been tirelessly pointing out for a couple years, where basically, true, the internet of today is one where once you get on, you can pretty readily get along anonymously. People just don't know where you are. But, and in fact, the Communications Decency Act, which some people may remember, this was passed to prevent pornography, material that could be so-called harmful to minors, from falling into the hands of children. The way it worked was, it said, if you are an internet website and you are supplying this kind of material, either for money or not, you have to take efforts to make sure that kids can't see it. The argument that was made by free speech advocates as to why this was an unconstitutional requirement was that there was just no way to tell the kids from the adults. So in effect, they were banning this material from everybody because you couldn't single out the kids and exclude them. That is now changing. Basically, some of these technologies, the previous caller referred to the speed and the reliability and encryption technologies, these are the technologies that let you authenticate who you are. Some third party, maybe it's the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, can certify that you are, say, above 18, or a licensed driver, or a convicted felon, or not. And those sorts of things that can be certified and then readily verified, thanks to the technology, are the things that could make it so that a website could single out Minnesotans or Americans from everybody else. Once that can be done, it's not too far a step to imagine government being able to pressure those websites to actually make those distinctions.
We're getting ready for the electronic millennium on the Connection this hour with a big picture look at the internet. Jonathan Zittrain is our guest. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Massachusetts, working to bring peace of mind through the family plans, and by the MathWorks, sponsoring the Promise Summer Program for future math and science leaders, thanks to an all-company charity auction, a revolutionary place, MathWorks.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Listeners support us, along with Dr. Maurice Vanderpoel, saluting the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute for its contributions to psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, as well as providing consultation and referral services. And J&C Adams Company in Cambridge, featuring Anderson smooth gliding patio doors and Anderson energy efficient windows. 800-446-0303. In the forecast today, a hot and humid afternoon ahead. Look out for a thunderstorm either late this afternoon or early in the evening. A high today expected right around the 90-degree mark. Tonight, we'll see a low between 65 and 70 degrees. Tomorrow's going to be partly sunny, less humid. A high expected in Greater Boston in the mid-80s. Other WBUR supporters include Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term and long-term computer rental solutions throughout New England for over 14 years. And Boston Renegades, women's soccer in Framingham, playing the Delaware Genies this Friday night, presented by TJ Maxx. Ticket information at bostonrenegade.com. This is WBUR, Boston, Cape Cod, and the Islands. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, scientists are using a new technique to increase the population of captive elephants.
Pull it back slowly.
Artificial insemination of elephants and the day's news later on NPR's All Things Considered.
This afternoon at 4 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the Internet this hour. We're told over and over again that the transformation involved in an electronic millennium goes deeper even than the Gutenberg revolution or the television revolution. The world, it'll be a new world, a virtual internet world in commerce, in education, in life in a year or two. Jonathan Zittrain is giving us a sort of a general overview and how to get ready for it. He runs the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. A story or two, Jonathan, please, about people who have mastered or learned how to ride this wave or been drowned in it. Well, out of your own experience.
A few examples, and I'm sure many of the listeners will be familiar with them. The first, it's hard to avoid talking about a fellow named Matt Drudge. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Of course.
He does
Drudge Report?
Exactly. This is a web page for which anybody, any self-respecting web designer would go into conniptions upon seeing it. It's basically just Drudge Report in big letters across the top. Occasionally there is an icon of a flashing siren when he has a story he particularly wants to emphasize. And then he just has a bunch of links. It's a great example of everybody else's content assembled under one roof. And people then go to the Drudge Report as a way of first having those quick links to all the other content, everything from AP News to the various publications online.
Monica sightings. And
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also done his own kind of freelance reporting, one where, talk about an emerging standard, because he becomes known as the person to whom people leak, people call him and then promptly leak to him. And he's somebody who has quite proudly said he doesn't filter his news nearly to the extent that Dan Rather would or any other kind of big player, sophisticated media entity, one that might have to worry, say, about defamation laws. And
all the news, whether it's fit to be printed or not, okay.
Exactly, and he's gotten enormous success. I don't know if he's made a killing on it, but he's certainly got enough eyeballs looking at his site that one traditional means of making a killing, which is to get a lot of eyeballs looking at your site and then sell advertising space, is clearly open to him as a path. Now, a couple...
Open to him, but has he...